What I would like to do in the next hour or so, we're not going to go on for much longer, is to do three more things. Transformational leadership is an approach by scholars. It is an attempt to modulate, to moderate some of the negative aspects of great man theory, of this original understanding of leadership. And the reason why we have to modulate and moderate some of this is that we have to remember that whatever we do as leaders, we are always standing in the place of the ultimate leader. If the truth be told, there's only one Lord, one King, one leader. And even the greatest leaders are actually really just servants, as followers. And so we have to attempt somehow to bring in this attribute of Christ and make sure that we serve Him really well. And so to summarize what we've said so far is that charismatically or transformational leaders do four things. They try to influence by their being, by who they are, the very person that they are. If you look back at the history of Christians, the Christians that we remember are those who were exceptional people who would stand out. Look at somebody like Mother Teresa. We cannot follow everything Mother said. The girl was a bit strange at times. I mean, there are books and things I've just read. I don't know if you've just read her memoirs just came out. Her letters, her personal journal. It's an incredible reading, but you can see, you know, some things were a bit strange at times. But the reason why we like Mother is because of her character. There's not a single Christian or non-Christian that can criticize Mother Teresa. It is physically impossible. People have tried. You cannot do it because of the person that she became. And transformational leaders attempt to do that. We also motivate people predominantly by trying to inspire them, showing them a different way. I don't want to tell you this is not easy. South Africa's got unique challenges. Somebody asked me earlier, why did you not teach on servant leadership? Why did I not call this servant leadership? This has elements of servant leadership. The problem with that is the history of South Africa. A term such as servant leadership doesn't work well. The concept works very well, but not the term. Why would it not work well? Imagine a white man standing in front of the multitude of our people and telling them to serve. What do they hear? They hear domestic servant. A white male telling them to be a domestic servant as a leader. And so they do not hear what I'm trying to say. So this idealized or this inspirational motivation is very, very difficult. We have to help people change their minds. The third aspect here is this issue of intellectual stimulation. Help our followers really think about the big, larger issues in life. So this group here, some of you are in business, some of you are leaders, some of you are being trained for ministry, some of you are currently in leadership. This kind of training situation is always dangerous. The greatest danger here is that we train you to do what you need to do now. If we do that, we have failed. The skills we need to train you should not just be for today. As leaders, we must be thinking about what are the skills you're going to need 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years from now. I'll give you a few practical examples. My son spends years learning how to write. I cannot remember the last time I wrote anything down. It's true. I'm not saying intellectually this is a waste of time. I understand that there are developmental things that happen when people learn to write. But is that a skill we use? I wish somebody taught me how to type. That's a skill that I can use right now. I type with 5.5 fingers. And I'm finished. I cannot. I've tried now to learn, you know, the right way to type. It's too late. It's no longer possible because I've got all these bad habits, you know, doing all kinds of bizarre things. It's true. I think of my son. I think of all the languages that he's learning. I am determined that before he is 16, he will be able to read and speak Mandarin Chinese. Or Arabic, that's the other one. I would love for him to know. I've decided myself, I want to learn Mandarin. I want to get to that place. There's no choice. And so part of what we have to do is that we have to train our leaders in skills that they will need in the future. In the future. That's going to be important. I wish somebody taught me right at the beginning of my ministry how to use email. And you might say, well, that's the easiest thing. No, it's not. It's not the writing of the email or sending or receiving it. It's what you do with an email. South Africans use emails as faxes. They use email to create distance. You send an email that you don't have to deal with it now. In the rest of the world, people use emails as texting. The general rule at our university is an email must be answered in 5 minutes. So you can imagine my shock. Oh, I got an email. Oh, I'll give attention to it next week. Lose your job. Quick, quick, quick. Immediate decisions. I wish somebody would have taught me that. My biggest problem with emails is still that I write them as letters. Dear so-and-so, thank you for your note. I am so, you know, like, you remember how you were taught in school how to write a letter? People look at me, strange. And the problem is I receive up to 600, sometimes emails, mostly about 200, 250 a day, but it can go much higher. Can you imagine you try to write all of this? I had to learn. My boss, Winston, when he writes an email back, it's a horrible experience. He sends email back and he says, I write this long, three-page, emotional letter. He writes back, fine. What does fine mean? Have you ever had one of those? Or understood? Freaks me out. I wrote back, I said, define fine. He sent me a link to a dictionary. Easy. Fine is fine. What more do you want? I want him to write, dear so-and-so, thank you for trusting me with all of this information. I have read this. I have prayed about it. And so part of what we have to learn to do is that we have to prepare our people for the future. Increasingly, we're going to live in a globalized world. None of us can think of ourselves as exclusively South African. We have to firstly think of ourselves as African. I can see this in America. This is an incredible problem. And I can only say it here. Americans really struggle when it comes to world geography. They have, this is no exaggeration, they have no idea. Oh, you come from the country of Africa. Actually, it's a continent. No way. Yes, with more than 50 countries. No way, you lie. True. Or I say, I come from South Africa. Which country in South Africa do you come from? It's actually a country all by itself. No way. Or the one that I always get. I will say to them, I'm an African. No, you're not. Yes, I am. You what? You're not an African. My family's been there for 400 years. You're not. They will fight with me. It's true. And so we have to learn to prepare. Americans are not prepared for the rest of the world. Most of the people, when I say I'm from South Africa, they say, is it close to Mexico? All the time I get that. It's true. And I say, a little bit more south and a little bit more east. And then somehow you will get there, just a tiny little bit. It's a part of what you want to do. If you're followers, you want to prepare them. But you see, what is the problem? The problem is that they are so centered in their own existence. They only teach American geography, and they only teach at school American history. Know nothing of Europe, know nothing of the rest of the world. Have no idea. Would not be able to tell you in which country the city of Paris is found. Would not know. All the time they would say, the country of Europe.
Serious?
Yeah, Europe is one country. And this is general. It's a massive shock. It's almost impossible to imagine, but it's true. Why is that? Focused on themselves. In the present moment. And one of the biggest mistakes that we can make as leaders is that we are too relevant for now. You have to look further. What will your followers need 15, 20, 25, 30 years from now? What will they need? How will you prepare them? One of the things that's very interesting, and I'll quickly say this and then I'll move on. The charismatic movement failed 20 years ago. And I'll tell you why they failed. We stopped teaching doctrine. Why did we stop teaching doctrine? Because we thought, we've got our people. None of them believe any kind of heresy. At least that's what we believed 20 years ago. Everybody's fine. We don't have to spend a lot of time speaking about basic Bible doctrines. Not knowing the internet was going to come. For the first time in the history of mankind, every ordinary person has got access to every possible heresy in the world. How many people have you heard say the following? I've researched it on the internet. True. And now our people don't know. And this is why you get the craziest stuff out there. You have no idea. People are just swallowing absolutely every possible thing that they can find. The amount of heresies from the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and 5th century that's back in the church is massive. Gnosticism is back alive and well. Brian McLaren. I know I'm going to get you upset. Brian has come out of the closet. Brian says the God of the Old Testament is not God.
Serious?
It's a recent statement. Brian had his whole church keep Ramadan with readings from the Quran last year. And this is a leader. Antinomianism. Lawlessness is back. Big time. Big time. There are people who stand up now and say that the law that was given at Mount Sinai was not from God. And I can mention names. But we're so unfamiliar with all of those heresies, we don't know how to really address those. What do you think is going to happen 20 years from now? Every possible heresy will increase in power and in strength, and people have access to it. And therefore, our individual members must know. Give you few quick examples. In the 2nd and the 3rd and the 4th century, we fought major battles against heresies. We also fought major battles against heretical books. The Book of Enoch, the Gospel of Judas, the Secret Gospel of Peter, which should have remained secret, the Gospel of Mary, and I can go down the list. We forgot those battles that we fought in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th and 5th century because those books disappeared. They are back. If you go to Exclusive Books or Barnes & Noble, you can find more books on apocryphal gospels than what you can find on the real gospels. There are churches in America, one particular one, that has included the Gospel of Thomas in their New Testament now. There are charismatic churches who base their doctrine on the Book of Enoch, which is an apocryphal book. There are lots of Afrikaners who do as well. And the thing is, our general public, our population, our congregation is unable to address that. Now that it's going to increase because people are going to have access to absolutely everything, you have to train your followers better. Every single follower in the church must be an expert in basic Bible doctrine.
Yeah, that word religious is so I'm going to just hit that thing and just forgive me for it for a moment, but I agree with you. I think that's the reason why people don't want to go there. We've been very stupid in our use of terms. We've been really, really stupid. So we say things such as, and I know I'm going to offend people here. We say, I am not religious. I'm a lover of Jesus. It makes me so upset, I want to go and hit that person. And I have to really control myself. Because we don't think of the larger implications. The word religion is a word that the New Testament uses. Pure and undefiled religion is. Now we say that word is a bad word. We've fallen into the trap of the world. There is only one religion. And when we say Christianity is not a religion, we lie. It is the only religion. It's a biblical word. It's like this other stupidity. We don't teach theology. We just teach the Bible. Just ready. Theology means the knowledge of God. What is it about the knowledge of God that you don't teach? Think about it. So what do? We take real words and we strip them of their real meaning and stuff them with false meaning. We fall into the trap of the world. Now, in the world sense, theology means something else, but we have to rescue those words back. Language is degenerating, and we have to save that. And let me tell you why we have to save language. Because once language has become degenerate, we are unable to share the gospel. In truth. Simple things such as cool is no longer cool. It is hot. Think about that. And hot might not be hot, it might be cool. All these words that we change, and so we get into this hip kind of nonsense. If I have to share with you the craziness of stuff that's going on in the States right now, there are ministries that use drug references to describe their relationship with God. It is immoral. It is irreverent. They will speak about toking the ghost. Yes, toking the ghost. Toking is a slang word for smoking bacha. We toke the ghost. No fear of God. No fear. You have to learn to use language correctly. And so we have to prepare our people. What's happening with the church that increasingly we have dumbed down Christianity? Just dumbed it down. What's the general feeling? We're not going to go deep. We're not going to go deep. We're not going to go deep. We're just going to stay on the surface. Well, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get surface Christians. People that can handle no truth and can deal with none of the issues. Christians should be the deepest thinkers on the face of the earth, able to engage in any conversation. And by the way, it's not only Christianity in the church. It's happening in education. I get so upset when people just simply are not trained as they should be trained. They should have knowledge. And so I want to encourage you, as you prepare your followers, this intellectual stimulation is of tremendous importance. And then lastly, this issue of individualized attention. So two further things that I quickly want to deal with. The first one deals with a theory here, and this might be important. How do we build organizations that are transformational? This comes from Gary Yuckel's work. I'm going to add a bit to it. I don't agree with everything. But I'm going to give you the theory out there, and then I'll bolt a little bit on it. This is such basic foundational material on how do we build these not just leaders that are transformational, but organizations that in their very nature becomes places that are conducive for growth. You do know that you can build an organization that's sick. There are organizations that by their very nature sick. Sick. There's another word for it, cultish. There are church organizations that people walk into and they don't get healed, they get injured. They walk away more broken than what they were before. So the question is, how do you do that? Yuko says there are five steps, and I'm going to quickly take you through these. The first thing that he says is to develop a challenging and attractive vision together with the employees. I'm going to moderate this a little bit. What I would say is discover the vision that comes from God. The job of the leader is to spend an inordinate amount of time in prayer with God. Always asking the question, what do you want me to do? What Yuko though says is correct. It's not that the vision comes from the employees, but you test it with your people. You build this in community. We have to spend a lot of time asking this question, what does God want from me? Do not fall for fads. Starbucks, are you familiar with Starbucks in the States? Huge big deal. Starbucks almost lost its business 5 years ago. Almost closed shop. Starbucks is known for its coffee. Have you ever seen the Starbucks cup? Do you know what the logo says? What's the logo? There's a mermaid on the logo. Do you know what that is about? It's addiction. Mermaids were sirens who sat on rocks and sang to sailors, and the sailors would find themselves unable not to listen to the song. They were attracted, and then they would sail their ships right on those rocks, and the mermaids would get them. Of course, what is Starbucks about? It's about addiction, coffee addiction. I'm familiar with this addiction. I am praying for God to deliver me. I hear the song of the siren every day. This is a problem. But here's the thing. Starbucks, a while back, decided to sell teddy bears, music, coffee cups, games, all kinds of nonsense. And they didn't focus on what they were called to do. They almost lost it. But 5 years ago, the new CEO stepped in and said, enough. We make coffee. We sell coffee. What happens when churches stop doing what they are called to do? There's no need for them, and they will go away. We have ministries that have become so big that they need to raise millions per day to stay afloat. So then the whole programming, the whole outreach is about raising funds to stay afloat. So now the only purpose why you exist is to pay the rent. It's a paradox. And the moment that you do that, it's an Abilene paradox. What do? You have to stop for a moment and say, there's no need for you. We're going to close the doors. And so part of what we have to do is that we must make sure that this vision, Gary Yuckel's attractive vision, I'm going to say a godly vision, is real. You must know what has God called you to do. Secondly, you must hook the vision with the strategy for its achieving. It's a very simple thing. When you plan, always ask the question, did God call us to do this? Did God call us to do this? There are no ends of activities that you can engage in. As shofar, you can be busy until Jesus comes back, doing things that you were not called to do. You have to make sure that whatever you plan is the original call. Spend a lot of time. You will waste a lot of money. You will lose a lot of people. You'll lose all of your energy. Only do what God's called you to do. The third thing here is develop the vision, specify, and translate it into actions. You have to spend a lot of time asking the question, how do we do this? What are the practical things that we need to do? And this happens very well in a group setting. Once you understand what is that vision, what did God call you to do? You ask the question. What are the specific steps I need to take? What do I need to do? I had a good friend from Italy come and visit Regent a while back. He's an Italian minister. He spent 2 years in a Bible college and then dropped out. He didn't finish his degree, but he's been ministering for 20 years. So he's walking on our beautiful campus. He loves the university. And at the end of it, he says, you must get me a job here. It's a very Italian way of talking. And I said, all right. I said, I don't think it's possible. I said, but send me your CV, your educational CV. So he sent it to me. And I looked at it, so I phoned him back and I said, now, how long have you had the dream to teach at a university? All my life. All my life, it's my vision to be a university professor. I said, so why did you not study? His vision did not translate into the appropriate actions. It's a simple thing. I have a friend in England that phones me every second week. He's a young man that is passionate for God. He's young. He's in his late 30s. He phones me. He's very alone. He probably has some form of social anxiety disorder, I think. I'm trying to get him with a church. I'm trying to get him for somebody that can help him with this. But he phones me to complain about the fact that he doesn't have a wife. Well, and at one point I just lost it. I said, well, do you think they're going to deliver this wife at your door? Guess what? You first have to wash. You have to wash your hair. You have to be presentable. Guess what? You have to go where the girls are. These are practical things. So he has the vision of being married. He has the need to be married. He has the desire to be married. But there are no actions. It's a simple thing. If you want to be an evangelist, you have to go where the lost is. If you want to be the light on the hill, you must go where it's dark. It's basic things. And so it's of tremendous importance here. Number four, as the leader, you must express confidence, decisiveness, and optimism about the vision and its implementation. This is maybe the hardest part. Leaders must be steadfast in what God's called them to do. God delights in calling stubborn people. There's a reason for it. There's a godly stubbornness that is important. And a leader is the kind of person that hears from God and does not look to the left or the right. Just remains focused. Focused. I am fascinated by Mother Teresa and her leadership. I have two students working on her in their dissertations on her life. Yes, she's dead. She's buried. We're not going to get her. I don't know what to do with this group. I think we will have to pray a bit more, Morna. Yes. I have some more material for prayer now. Yeah. Think of Mother in just in a moment. The reason why she was so incredibly successful is that she remained focused to the end for almost 60 years. And this is what God's called me to do. And it's possible. And it's possible. I was in a meeting, probably the most difficult meeting, and I can say it here, I cannot say it in America, anywhere else. At Regent, a few months back, I'm asked to lead a task group to develop a new course for undergraduate students coming in, their entrance course. And since it's hooked with our mission, our entrance course is called On the Making of a Christian Leader. And one of our new professors who came, very distinguished gentleman, is on the task group. And I'm leading it, and so we start off. And he looked at the title and he said, this is an offensive title. I said, what do you mean? He says, I don't think it is possible to make a leader, and certainly it's impossible for universities to make Christian leaders or to graduate Christian leaders. And my response was incredibly strong, probably too strong. And what happened, ultimately, it got really to a bad place, and he lost his job, which was right. I have to honestly say this to you. If our mission is to graduate Christian leaders to transform the world, and we have a professor that says it is impossible to graduate Christian leaders, you must go. This is not the right place for you. Go teach somewhere else. If you don't believe in the vision, don't be there. You are a distraction. And leaders must be confident that what God's called them to do is possible. God has given a mandate to shofar. If you don't believe it, don't be here. The followers will look to you if this is possible. I see this with my son. He's looking to me consistently to tell him that to live godly is possible. To raise a family is possible. I grew up without a father. My father died when I was 12. And let me just stop for a moment and say to you, you know what's been the most difficult thing for me in growing up? I had no example in front of me. So when I married, how scary. How do you make this work? I had to go to the church. Finding a job, how scary. Nobody there to guide me. I've noticed that the major job that I have with my son is to provide him with confidence. When I taught him to ride a bike, he's very scared. He's Italian. You know? So this is the whole thing. I am going to die. You know, everything is very extreme. I'm going to die. I'm not able to do this. And for Jonathan, it's always, this is the best day of my life. This is the worst day of my life. In the same breath. It's the worst day of my life. I'm on this contraption. I'm going to die. I'm not going to make it. And 5 minutes, he learned how to ride the bicycle. Oh, this is great. I am able to do this. That's my job. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And if you want an organizational, if you want a transformational organization, your job is to always pronounce what is possible. For too long, we've had leaders stand up and say, we will never be holy. We've stood up and said, it is impossible to live a holy and pure life. And so we haven't. Yet Jesus says, Peter says, be holy as God is holy. For years we've had people say it's impossible to have unity in the church. And Jesus says, Father, I pray that there will be one. We said it's impossible to reach the world. The psalmist says, one day all the earth will worship you. So part of what we have to do is once we have that vision, proclaim it, believe it, be optimistic, live it within your heart. And lastly, you realize the vision through small planned steps and small successes in the path for its full implementation. And here, Yukul is correct. Baby steps. Small steps are more important than big steps. Small steps. Small steps. I cannot say this stronger than what I am. You have to take small, small steps towards this. It's the small steps you take every day that will determine where you will end up. Not the big things. Not the big steps. And it's ridiculous how people are. A good friend of mine sent me, well, not a good friend, an acquaintance of mine that was at school with me, is now in ministry, and he sent me a fundraising note. He's got a church of 250 people optimistically. If it counts legs. I think. So there it is. 250. I know a lot of people in that congregation. I know the situation. He has now received the vision. I'm not saying the vision is not of God. He's going to build a 12,000-seater auditorium. Praise God. Go for it. Don't build it this year. Don't build it now. He's raising funds to start building. He's got the ground that he wants to buy. They can hardly pay the rent at the moment. And now he's sending it wide. spread he wants to raise, all of this money to do it absolutely immediately. He's a fool. He's been watching a movie, Field of Dreams. Build it and they will come. You cannot build the church and they will come. You only build, by the way, you'd only build the building when there's no more space. Because you're not in the business of building buildings. That's not church ministry. You're in the business of building the church. Working with Christ who is building the church. So these are the five steps, Gary, you could say it. Now let me just quickly focus and then we'll end kind of there. On how do we construct compelling visions and transformative values? And this again is typical transformational theory. I'm going to give you the theory and I'm going to add a bit to it. But this is the biggest deal. How do we get to that? Now this is organizational theory. I'm going to moderate it a little bit and tell you what I think the scriptures have to say about it. Number one, you must locate the vision in the organization. How do you do that? Organizational theory, because they're missing the word of God, will say you have to look at the history, you have to look at the purpose, the values, and the followers. I'm saying all of that is correct, but there's one thing missing. You have to spend time with God. You have to spend a huge amount of time trying to understand. And you see, now here again, the word vision. Remember I talked to you about language degenerate? That word vision, we've changed the meaning of that word. When we think vision now, what do we think? We think end product. Do you know that 50 years ago, the word vision meant something different? It meant have your eyes open to have vision. And if you have vision, how far can you see? You can see the horizon. I'm going to say a radical thing that might upset you a little bit. God's idea of vision is not a finished product. It's to have your eyes wide open and move towards what you can see. We've made a massive mistake in constructing complete visions at the end. It's to have your eyes open.
So it can change.
It changes in depth, yes, but not in direction. There's slight modifications. But as you move, you'll see more. And that's true of nature. I want to tell you, you need to learn this about God. God is not deeply interested in your comfort level. I'm going to try to tell you the truth. He wants you to find your comfort in Him. Think about money. How many of you need money, extra money every month? I do. I pray. I pray every month. I say, God, I need this money. That money comes in every single month. Now, let me just stop for a moment and tell you. This is a massive problem. I said to the Lord the other day, because, you know, I'm practical. I said, this is an incredible waste of time. I spend all this time praying and trusting. You give it. I'm grateful. I praise you. And then we do it again. I said, let's do the following. You give me all the money I need for the rest of my life. I'll put it away. I'm at peace. You're at peace. It's a perfect solution. I will be absolutely grateful. Why would the Lord not do it? Because my comfort is no longer in Him. If you read the Bible, go look at it over and over and over again. It's this idea of having your eyes open. Not long-term problem. Having your eyes open. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet. Not a spotlight, just a lamp. Just a lamp. Give me this day my monthly groceries. Give me this day daily bread. And so what leaders must learn to do is have their eyes open. Now, Yuko here is correct that you have to look at history. If you want to see the future, one of the clearest ways to see the future, think of a pendulum or a swing. You have to swing back into the past, and the further you swing back, the more you'll be able to move in. As leaders, you have to tell the story. How many of you were here when Shofar was started? You guys are important. You have to tell the story over and over and over. Never stop telling the story. Because when God started this movement, this church, some pivotal prophecies were made. Correct? That's it. The moment you stop telling this story, you've robbed yourself of your future. You're finished. Always tell the stories. And tell them over and over again. Even if people say, I've heard it a million times. Listen. When the people of Israel came out of Egypt, what's the first thing Moses did in the desert? Think how crazy this is. He sat down and wrote the history. There's no future unless you know where you come from. That's that vision. It gives you perception. It gives you openness. You're able to know what to do. The second step is develop the vision. Make it clear. Link it to strategy. Translate into action. It's not that you are defining the vision. You're just making it palatable, clear, so that people can understand it. You want to make sure that all your strategy, all your actions are linked to this. Every time you make a decision, you have to ask this question. Am I called to do this? Is this my call? Is this what this church is called to do? The third thing that you have to do is communicate the vision to all. So this is my major problem. My inner world is much larger than my outer world. So what very often happens in my family, well, it's sometimes because I don't get a word in. I don't often say what's going on in my head. And so then I make long-term decisions for our family that I've been praying about. But since it's so logical to me, I don't share it with no one. And then I'm in church and I'm preaching. My wife sits there and I mention something. And she was right there in the church, put up her hand and say, that's new to me. It's very embarrassing when that happens. It's a problem. You have to share it with everyone. And one of the best ways to share it is through your aesthetics. In your organization, use everything aesthetically to communicate, because people are not only auditory learners. They learn through what they see, through what they experience. One should be able to walk into your organization and within 5 minutes be able to say who you are and what you do and where you're going. Use everything within your arsenal to tell people that. And you can do that if you're renting buildings. I think Shofar's done a marvelous job. When I walk into one of your buildings, if you're just having a service, I know it's Shofar. I see the orange a mile away. Love it. Love it. It works. But you have to make sure that whatever you communicate is true about your vision. The big question you have to ask, let me be a little bit in us. All your aesthetics, would somebody be able to step in and tell people what this is about? Can somebody walk into your buildings and without people telling them, they can say, you know what, Shofar is about this. This is their call. These are their values. This is where they're going. Everything needs to be the same. Number four, personally lead with the vision. If you lead, they will follow. It's a very simple thing. If you lead, they will follow. Make sure you stand. Make sure you do this. And the last one here is measure and celebrate key success points in the implementation of the vision. Again, it's this idea. There are times that you should stop, because people can very easily become very discouraged. If you give them this big thing all the time, and after 30 years, you're not there, you have to stop at moments and say, you know what, this is a milestone we've reached. I'm going to try to say this gently. As an Afrikaner, we don't celebrate well. We don't know how to do this. Something happened with us. White Afrikaners, something happened to us when we came here. Seriously, some good things happened, but we lost. We can learn from our black brothers and sisters. They know how to celebrate. Say it again, my sister, yes. But the white Afrikaners, let me say, the white Africans, we don't know how to celebrate. We don't know how to party. I am too serious. When it comes to the stuff,
I don't want to waste any time partying. I just want to do. But you have to stop at moments and say, let's look back a little bit. How far have we come? It goes together with the stories of the beginning. You say, this is what God has told us in the beginning. These are the milestones. This is what we've reached. This is what God's done. Tell the story all the time and stop and celebrate. I've decided to do this with my son. Birthdays are now huge in our families. It's his 10th birthday this year. I've already set aside, I've decided, his 10th and his 20th, 30th, 40th, 50th, I'm going to set aside a week. There are significant things I'm going to do with him. I'm going to sit down at his 10th birthday and tell him the story from his birth till now. Give him the opportunity to reflect what has happened. Give him a glimpse of where he's going. We have to learn to do the same. And when we're able to do it, when we're able to do this, I think our organizations will change. Let me end with this. So the best example that we can have, of course, remains Christ. The difficulty is that we've created a Christ in our own image. And so as a leader, we need to revisit it. There's a reason why I've put that picture up for you. That is the first artistic rendition of Jesus as a sculpture. What is fascinating to me is that the early church described their leaders as shepherds. Now here's a problem again. We've lost the meaning. A shepherd was the lowest socioeconomic job in the first century. See, when we think of shepherds, we think rolling green hills, fluffy little lambs around the shoulders. That's not a shepherd. Anybody here been to the Middle East? Have you seen shepherds? Are they clean or dirty? What's a sheep like? Horrible job. So the poorest of the poor are shepherds. Imagine the leaders in the early church, they chose the lowest job to describe the function of the leaders. What's the lowest job in Stellenbosch? Refuse removal? Street cleaner? Car guard. Imagine we call our leaders street cleaners. That's the function. That's who you are. You clean the streets. Think of the term apostle. When we say apostle today, what do we think?
Main man.
Yeah. Funny hat, special throne, special car, all kinds of things that we have. So I'm in China, and I'm interested in their Bible translation. So what's very curious, the Chinese translation of the New Testament used a Japanese word to translate the word apostle. At some point, there's painful history between Japan and China. They don't like one another. There's a lot of painful history here. The Japanese at some point tried to occupy them and treated them really badly. And so there was a very bad word. There was kind of a Japanese hybrid Chinese word, which is described for people that worked as the servants of the Japanese. And the Chinese word here, it's a hybrid word, Japanese word, is tsotso. So in the New Testament, Chinese New Testament, the apostle is a tsotso. What's a tsotso? Running dark. What is an apostle? An apostle is a saint one. So in the New Testament, if you don't want to go to the market, send a slave, apostle, servant. And so the New Testament makes use of these terms
to describe the radical nature of our authority. Our authority is not a positional power. Authority is the fact that we're obedient to God and it's His authority that steps in. It's just these paradoxical images. And so Jesus, as a transformational leader, leads predominantly through His being, His character, His values. And as He does this, He inspires people to do the same by providing them with a new way of thinking and seeing by giving people individualized attention. Yesterday we looked at that hymn, and I want to touch on this as I end. And Paul writes, your mind, your attitude, again, this change in mind, should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature of God, is not considered equality of God something to be grasped. Think of that. Jesus was God. He is God. And He says, I'm not going to come and lead from that position. I'm going to willingly give that up in order to lead. But He made Himself of nothing. He made Himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance of man, He humbled Himself, became obedient to death. And as such, we see five leadership values of Jesus. This becomes His transformation. And I'm only going to speak about one as I end, maybe the most difficult one. And this is where the transformation will happen. In this hymn, five values: self-emptying, service, humanity, that common humanity, looking like a man, let people touch you as a man, humility and obedience. I want to speak, though, about the self-emptying aspect. We get this theological construct, kenosis, from this word kenaos, strong aorist here. It's a difficult word. It could mean many different things. But I'll explain it in this way. The rabbis say that the first thing that God did was not to create the heavens and the earth. The first time I heard it, I thought, heresy. Because my Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the first thing. The rabbis say, no. Follow their logic. They say, if in the beginning God was everything, it's only God. The first thing, act of God, was not to create, but to make space for something else to exist. To withdraw from space, to create space for something else to exist that's not Him. And so they say this attitude of self-emptying or making space for something else to exist is not only the first act of Jesus, it's the first act of God. The Swiss theologian Balthasar wrote a whole book on this. And he says, the first act of God is a kenotic act. What's the first thing that leaders do? We create space for somebody else to grow, to develop, to become. It's not about us. We've been studying this term extensively in leadership. And at the moment, we believe that it's the following aspects here. That this kind of leadership is marked by voluntary self-limitation. Man, this is difficult stuff for me. I must not give the answers to my students too quickly. I must sometimes limit. If God can limit Himself in order for someone else to grow, I must be willing to do the same. Secondly, vulnerability. We spoke about this yesterday, present to others. Voluntary powerlessness, purification from self-centeredness, humility, self-sacrifice, openness to the other. Yves Regan, who is a very famous missiologist, describes it in this way. He says, kenosis then is the gateway to mutual understanding and beyond this to an intimate sharing that is the consummation of a relationship in union. By dispossession of self, we are able to absorb the amazing riches of others. There's something extraordinary that Jesus did that gave us a new vision, a new way of doing all of that. So this leads me to the last thing that I want to say here. And so we've realized that what we need is a new definition of leadership. I told you I am not a huge fan of Peter Northouse's definition. Here I think is something slightly better. Joseph Jaworski writes this. He says, leadership is not about positional power. It's a mistake we've made. It's not about accomplishments. It's ultimately not even about what we do. Leadership is about creating a domain in which human beings continually deepen their understanding of reality and become more capable of participating in the unfolding of the world. This is a secular definition, but I want to tell you, this is incredible stuff. This is what leaders do. I make space for others to hear God's word, to obey it, and to become who God's called them to be. And ultimately, leadership is about, I would change this word, creating realities to facilitating the unfolding of true reality. God has a very special call on this group. It is almost impossible not to walk into your midst and sense your destiny. It's very difficult not to. Your destiny is alive. It's very visible. It's tangible. What I would plead with you to do is to use this example of Christ and create an organization that is transformative and not transactional. An organization that will allow people to be transformed in who God's called them to be. And then ultimately for you as leaders to lay down your lives so other leaders can come after you.
Bible translation can you recommend to?
Yes, that's a really good question. I get that all the time. For those who are not privileged enough, for those who God allows to study Greek and Hebrew, it's probably because they need to spend more time in the Word than the rest. Like me. I need to be there. That's a very difficult issue of Bible translations. I do want to tell you, the King James, so many problems. So many difficulties. The Message Bible is a wonderful book. It's not a Bible. It's a lovely retelling of the biblical story. In other words, it should never be read as a Bible, should not be used as a Bible, should not be preached from as a Bible, nor should the Amplified ever. Sorry. Never. The NIV has problems, as many, but it is substantially better than most. At the moment, what I like the ESV, English Standard Version. They've done really a huge amount of really good work on that. But most contemporary English translations that we have are fairly okay. The good news I would stay away from, I don't think it's very often, it was used here for a while, it's a very limited translation. But there's maybe a third dangerous one, the Message, it's a retelling. The Amplified, yes. And there are so many problems with it. It's changing the word, really. There's an addition that happens. It's a changing fundamentally of the Message that is incredibly dangerous. I would always stay away from one-person translations, such as the Dakes, that people really like. Just be careful for that. I don't think it's as much in vogue and fashion as it was 10 or 15 years ago. But you want to stay with, always choose a Bible that's been translated by a large group of responsible people rooted in churches, in community. That's generally the rule. Preferably have more than one translation, and you choose those translations as such. Yes, I would agree with that. Can I pray for you? The word that really comes to mind consistently for Shofar, for me, is that this is a season for you to open your eyes widely. Widely. Make sure you do three things. Make sure you remember to look back.
For those ones who were there right at the beginning, I'm pleading with you. Tell those stories. Tell them well. Make sure all the new people know those stories. Not only your successes, but your failures. Tell them over and over and over again. Secondly, I ask and I plead with you that you look very carefully at the present moment. Keep your eyes open. The church world very often, I don't know why this is so, we're just oblivious to what's going on outside of our walls. Pay attention. Pay attention. And then thirdly, let God open your eyes to what is possible in the future. Remember that He is in the past, He is in the present, He is in the future. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, was and is to come. How do you come to that is to come? You have to understand, was in my future, He is in my future. He is in my present moment. And the only way that you can draw a line is if you've got 2 points. 2 points. You've got that. If you're open and very clear about those two things, it will lead you to the future. But the word that comes to mind, really what I've sensed in the last 3 days, it's a time period for eyes to be wide, wide open. Gaze at Him. Look at Jesus. Look at Christ. So that you will be taken with His image once again. I'm remembering, and this has been in my mind for 3 days. There's a famous Russian book. I don't know why I'm remembering this. Written by Dostoevsky, I think, called The Idiot. Are you familiar with that book? Yes. This is no insult. This is a really good book. No, it's a book everybody should read, every Christian. The Idiot, it's a Christian book. It's a very famous Russian novel. And at one point, listen to me very carefully, he says, beauty will save us. Beauty will save us. And what he means by that, all the commentaries on this book says, that when the arrow of God has been shot, that arrow of beauty, that image of Christ, was at the same time beautiful and at the same time repulsive on the cross. Is that image that is able to change our minds. And what I want to say to you is that God has given you a vision of the future that is beautiful and terrible at the same time. Incredible things you have to do in the future, very painful things that you'll have to walk through in order to get there. But it's that beauty, true beauty. It's that rose and the thorns. It's that picture of Jesus on the cross, that compelling vision. And I'm remembering this, I don't know why, just this phrase, this beauty will save you. Let Christ become your vision. Be compelled by that. Let me pray. Father, I am humbled by my brothers and sisters and their commitment to you, their purity, their holiness, their sincerity, their passion and energy. Lord, I now pray that you will be fully formed in their midst. I pray that you will open our eyes that we might see you in our past. Open our eyes that we might see you in our present moment, and open our eyes that we may see you in the future. Christ, be our vision. Be our vision. And help us that once we see you, we'll be saved by this vision. By who you are. I pray this for my brothers and sisters. Open our eyes. Pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. God bless you. Thank you so much.